Welcome to the latest global news, recorded at 0300 hours GMT on Friday, the 2nd of July. I'm Komla Dumo with a selection of highlights from across BBC World Service News today. Coming up, another deadly suicide bombing in Pakistan. This time, a Sufi shrine in Lahore is the target. President Obama kicks off the debate on that most contentious of issues, immigration.
We cannot continue just to look the other way as a significant portion of our economy operates outside the law.
And Africa gets behind Ghana's Black Stars. It's quarterfinals day at the World Cup.
The expectation is that any time the World Cup is held on a continent, a team from that continent must win. We are on African soil.
But first, not long ago, suicide bombings in the Pakistani city of Lahore were extremely rare events. Not anymore. There have been several attacks this year, and now dozens of people have been killed in two suicide bomb attacks at the Datta Darba Shrine. Our correspondent in Pakistan, Ali Makbul, told Fergus Nicol what happened.
This happened at the Datta Darba Shrine in the centre of Lahore. Datta Darba is a place which anyone who knows Lahore will know about, one of the city's most famous landmarks, the shrine of a Sufi saint. And on Thursday evenings, it is extremely busy with devotees who get together and pray there. And police say there were hundreds of people at the shrine when, now they say, two suicide bombers blew themselves up within the crowd. And the latest they're saying is that 41 people were killed, but more than 170 wounded, and some of them critically.
Is this part of a pattern, Alim, or is this the first such atrocity in a while?
Well, in terms of attacks, of course, there have been all kinds of targets hit over the last 2 years, soft targets, so-called, in terms of markets, sporting events even, and mosques as well. But obviously hard targets have been hit as well, the army, intelligence agencies, police. Lahore has been the target much more over the last 6 months or so, but June had been a very quiet month. In fact, there were no suicide bombings in June at all, and police were congratulating themselves, security chiefs were congratulating themselves because it was the first month where there had been no attacks for the last 2 years, the only month where there were no suicide attacks in Pakistan. But the target is slightly different, this shrine, a Muslim shrine, of course, and of course it's Islamist militants that are being suspected of hitting a Muslim shrine. So that has drawn some attention. Certain shrines had been hit by Taliban militants in the past in the northwest of the country, never on this kind of scale, though. And people are saying that it might be something to do with the fact that these Islamist militants are now sort of hitting sectarian targets. The last big target was when over 80 people were killed in mosques used by the Ahmadi sect of Muslims, who the Taliban militants look on as heretics. And similarly, hardline Islamist militant groups consider it to be un-Islamic to pray at a shrine. They think that only God should be revered.
Ali Makbul in Islamabad. For the United States and its president, Barack Obama, immigration is a challenge which is not going to go away. There are an estimated 11 million undocumented or illegal immigrants in the United States, and every day more arrive. Most come from Latin America, and they are all the cause of fierce debate. Efforts to reform immigration laws have persistently flummoxed U.S. politicians, but now President Obama is promising to try again.
The system is broken, and everybody knows it. Unfortunately, reform has been held hostage to political posturing and special interest wrangling, and to the pervasive sentiment in Washington that tackling such a thorny and emotional issue is inherently bad politics.
Martin Abodaka is the Director of Communications at Reform Immigration for America, which supports a new look at the situation for undocumented immigrants. But is he out of step with many Americans who think that an amnesty could be seen as rewarding illegality?
As the president noted in his speech, that, you know, the people who come here legally or illegally, both of them are stuck with a system that is, you know, gives them very limited and very bad options. And frankly, most of the people who would make the argument that it just rewards illegality are the same people who want to deport 11 million people, even though it's not realistic. and it's not going to be a solution to what ails us.
So what is the solution? I mean, people have come to the country illegally, and the argument, at least what I seem to be hearing, is that since they've managed to stay long enough, they should just be allowed to stay.
Well, no, I think that that is, you know, what happened in 1986, right, when Republican President Ronald Reagan did a blanket amnesty. And if that were the case, and if it worked, we would not be in the position where that we are now with 11 million people here who are here illegally and a continuation of a broken immigration system. So what we need to do is find a comprehensive fix to this solution, and which is going to require, frankly, Republican leadership, which has not been forthcoming as of yet. But if we're going to do it, as the president noted, it's mathematically and politically impossible to do it without Republicans.
How do you explain the support that the measures taken by the Arizona government tighten the borders and to have background checks on people who are stopped? How do you explain the popularity of such actions in that state and indeed around the country?
Well, I think that what we see in Arizona is that the law is popular, and that comes from a number of different polls, which have confirmed that, you know, people are generally supportive of it in Arizona and elsewhere. But what's interesting is that the same polls also show an overwhelming number of people who support comprehensive immigration reform. And I think that what we're witnessing in a number of these different polls is that people, in the absence of any kind of leadership, are supportive of anything to fix the broken immigration system. So I don't necessarily think that it's support for specific measures like Arizona. It's support for people taking action to do something.
Time and time again, you hear, you know, analysts and pundits and politicians use the expression comprehensive immigration reform. You've used it a few times as we've had this conversation. What exactly does that look like? If it's passed, what will it be?
It would be a system that provides a path to citizenship for the 11 million people who are here undocumented, that respects the rights of all, that keeps families together, that deals with family backlogs, that creates a system that businesses can rely on for a stable workforce, that deals with issues of future flow. Frankly, that
encourages everybody south of the border to start heading for the United States?
No, because there would be a path to citizenship, but a legal way for you to come to the United States so that you're not incentivized to come here illegally. I mean, the problem we have with our system now is that there's a keep out sign right at the border, and a mile in, there's a help wanted sign. So we would remove the incentives for people to come here illegally and remove the incentives for businesses to hire illegal workers in the first place. I mean, we can't solve our broken immigration system and secure the border ever if we don't ever, you know, crack down on employers and remove that help wanted sign.
Martin Apodaca of Reform Immigration for America. Later on Friday, the last remaining African side, Ghana, is taking on Uruguay in the World Cup quarterfinal match. The South Americans have twice won the competition, in 1930 and 1950, before Ghana even gained its independence. No African team has ever made it to the semifinal, and Ghana's Black Stars will be cheered on by fans in many African countries as they try to make history. Will Ross is in the Ghanaian capital, Accra.
As Ghana's footballers, the Black Stars, try to make history, people all over Africa have thrown their support behind the team.
This is Ghana!
There's a feeling here that not for the first time, Ghana is leading the rest of the continent on an exciting journey.
Ghana, we now have freedom. Ghana, land of freedom. Toils of the brave and the sweat of their labors. Toils of the brave.
High life music soon after Ghana had broken away from British colonial rule. Ghana was a flag bearer. Its independence prompted many other countries to go their own way. Those were the golden days for two veteran footballers, 81-year-old James Adjei and Osei Kofi, who's just turned 70. I brought the two of them together to share a few memories with the help of some old black-and-white photos. James Adjei is considered one of Ghana's greatest ever footballers. His era was certainly different. Take the national team's tour to England in the 1950s.
It was not all that easy, because us at that time, there were no boots on.
No boots?
No, we didn't play in boots. We had no knowledge about playing in boots. We just played barefooted, and we were playing good football. In our first match, some disaster came. Our goalkeeper had to meet an oncoming player who wanted to score, and they clashed together. He had a broken leg.
Broken leg in the first game?
Yeah, in our first game. That was Wilberforce was his name. And one thing I remember is that the spectators, most of them were women. Whenever a player came against his opponent, they were closing their eyes and shouting that we were suffering. They were feeling pity for us.
Partly because you had no boots on.
Because we have no boots.
And you weren't paid anything?
We were not paid anything. There was nothing like we are seeing today. We played for the love of the game.
A few years after James Ajay's tour, the England legend Sir Stanley Matthews was heading in the other direction for a few exhibition matches in the newly independent Ghana.
No question of Stanley being a fish out of water, for these young men of Ghana are very promising footballers. Stan himself is in fine form. Over the bar, but never mind, in a few minutes Stanley's back again, as slippery as ever. A teammate grabs the pass, the goalie runs out, but he dodges him and the goal's wide open. All the spectators are cheering for Stanley, the uncrowned king of soccer. Uncrowned? The Hearts of Oak soon put that right with a proper coronation on a chief's throne of carved mahogany with an ivory scepter of office which he can take home with him to prove it all really happened. Julius Caesar never had it so good as this.
Ose Kofi was at the stadium to watch Stanley Matthews' tour of Ghana. Kofi was such a fine player himself, he earned the nickname One Man Symphony Orchestra because he could carry the whole side through a game. But he admits to deploying a few tricks back in the 60s, including the use of a white handkerchief to distract the opposition.
I would just drop the white handkerchief while the two of us are running, and your attention will by all means go on the white handkerchief. By the time you realize I've gone to score, I was using tricks and a lot of ideas.
Move the clock forward a few decades, and the Black Stars are not inspired by high life music, but hip life. And the football's changed a bit too. This is a training academy for teenagers run by the Dutch club Feyenoord. The pitches are artificial and the training sessions impressive. About 1,000 boys try to make it here each year. Just 15 are taken on. And like Ibrahim Adams, who's 17, they dream big.
I want to play for Arsenal.
Arsenal?
Arsenal. I hope to play for them in the future. And also Madrid or Barcelona.
Madrid or Barcelona?
From Arsenal.
All these small clubs you're choosing.
I know.
How would you feel if the World Cup came to Ghana?
If it comes to Ghana, I'll be very, very happy because Ghana will be the first African country to lift the World Cup, so I'll be very, very proud.
You'd have to go and kiss the cup?
Yeah, of course, after that, I'll definitely go and kiss the cup. So I wish all them all the best of luck, and I pray that they should be able to lift the World Cup.
Will Ross reporting from Accra. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he's willing to release 1,000 Palestinian prisoners to secure freedom for the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, who was captured by Palestinian militants 4 years ago. Mr. Netanyahu has been criticized by the soldier's family for not doing enough to secure his release. But in a live address on national television, Mr. Netanyahu said Israel was willing to pay a heavy price to have him freed. From Jerusalem, Wira Davies reports.
This does not appear to be a new policy statement from the Israeli government. It's more a confirmation from the Prime Minister that when a deal to release Gilad Shalit seemed imminent last December, Israel was prepared to free 1,000 Palestinian prisoners in exchange for the 23-year-old army sergeant. To mark the fourth anniversary of their son's capture by Palestinian militants from Gaza, Gilad Shalit's family and thousands of supporters are currently walking from their home in northern Israel to Jerusalem to highlight his continued captivity in Gaza. They say they'll remain camped outside the Prime Minister's residence until their son is released, and they've been critical of the government's efforts to free him. It's a campaign which has widespread support among the Israeli public and in the country's media. This live television address by Benjamin Netanyahu is being seen as an attempt to deflect some of that criticism, to show just how far he was prepared to go through German mediators to strike a deal with Shalit's captors. Mr. Netanyahu said that although all Israelis wanted the soldier back safely, the nation could not pay any price, because, he said, some militants released in earlier prisoner swaps had gone on to carry out further attacks against Israel.
Ira Davies reporting from Jerusalem. You're listening to Global News, the best stories, interviews, and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. It doesn't all need to be positive, of course, but Amir Trambu in New Delhi wrote in to say he loved the report on internet censorship in Turkey, which featured on Thursday's podcast. In Afghanistan, the Taliban says there's no question of entering into any kind of talks or negotiations with NATO forces. In a message passed on to the BBC, they say they believe they are winning the war and can't see any reason why they should enter into negotiations. That's not how the new man in charge of international forces in Afghanistan, General David Petraeus, sees it. He told a NATO meeting in Brussels today that it wasn't the case the Taliban have the upper hand. Our World Affairs editor, John Simpson, has been to the border area between Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Peshawar, on Pakistan's northwest frontier with Afghanistan. Noisy, much bombed, yet reasonably prosperous city, full of genuine experts on what's going on across the border, on the other side of the Khyber Pass in Afghanistan. It's rather startling to discover how widespread is the assumption in Peshawar that the Taliban are winning their war with the NATO forces. I went to a madrasa, or religious school, run by a well-known mullah, Sayyidul Arifin. He's not by any stretch of the imagination an extremist. On the contrary, his school is famously moderate. He's totally sure the Taliban are winning.
Their morale is very high, and the people are ready for a many long fight. I think there are innumerous mujahideen as are there in this region. So if this prolonged to 10 years more, so they can fight, I think.
In the West, this perception hasn't necessarily caught on among politicians and soldiers. But General David Petraeus, who has taken over command of the NATO forces in Afghanistan, clearly understands the nature of the problem that faces him. This is what he had to say in Brussels today.
Well, I think that there is no question but that the Taliban had the momentum, had the initiative, if you will, coming into this year. And indeed, one of the real areas of focus has been to reverse that process. And I think that has been reversed in certain areas of Afghanistan.
At the entrance to the Khyber Pass, with the heavy trucks rumbling on their way to Afghanistan, there are various people who know how to get a message through to the Taliban leadership.
Through a trusted intermediary, we've made contact with the authentic spokesman of the Taliban in Afghanistan, and he's just sent us through this statement. And he says, "We do not want to talk to anyone, not to President Karzai, nor to any foreigners, till the foreign forces withdraw from Afghanistan. We are certain that we are winning. Why should we talk if we have the upper hand and the foreign forces are considering withdrawal and there are differences in the ranks of our enemies?"
Not exactly very encouraging. And although it's true that there have been contacts with groups loosely associated with the Taliban, the organisation's leaders aren't in any mood to discuss things with NATO. Suppose the Taliban keep on resisting effectively and NATO, baffled, decides it's got to withdraw. What happens then? I went to see an old friend and contact of mine in Peshawar, Rahimullah Yousafzai, probably the best-informed observer along the border, and nowadays the editor of the much-respected newspaper, The News.
I don't think that there is any big support in popular terms for Taliban. You know, the majority of Afghans don't want Taliban to return to power. I think that if the foreign forces were to withdraw, I don't think that the Afghan government can survive for long, which means that Taliban would be back in power in most of Afghanistan. South, east, they'll be the dominant force. They may even be able to capture Kabul, but they will have problems in the north and in the west. So we will have a divided Afghanistan. It will be a very unhappy country under Taliban.
Does it really matter? Well, it certainly does to the Afghans, of course. The Taliban aren't some broadly based popular liberation movement. They're an ethnic group of Pashto speakers who want to impose their ferocious religious rules on the country once again. But the more the Taliban look like winning, the more local warlords will swing over to join them. It's all about perception, and General Petraeus has the job of changing this perception. Until he does, negotiation doesn't seem to be much of an option.
John Simpson, reporting from Peshawar in the northwest frontier province of Pakistan. The Tour de France starts this weekend, probably the most punishing event on the sporting calendar. But over the past few decades, many cyclists have found a way to get over the pain barrier. They've taken drugs. How many cyclists have pedaled their way through the Tour de France, doped up to the eyeballs, is anyone's guess. But doping became so prevalent that in 1986, one cyclist, Paul Kimmich, says he saw a fellow rider injecting himself in the shoulder for one last amphetamine rush before the mad dash up the Champs-Élysées. Kimmich rode the Tour de France for Ireland during the 1980s. He's now a sports journalist for the Sunday Times in London. He quit the sport to write a book entitled Rough Ride, Behind the Wheel with a Pro Cyclist, which lifted the lid on doping, including his own. Because, after refusing to take drugs, he told Mark Whittaker that he eventually succumbed.
I found myself, just after the Tour de France in 1987, in a room with eight teammates before one of these after-tour kind of criterium races, they're called. And my teammates broke out these small bags of amphetamines and start sharing them around. And I had resisted for almost 2 years before that and seen this done many, many times before. And it was a moment of weakness, and I decided to try and do as my peers were doing, and I used the amphetamine for that race and for two subsequent races. And then I made a decision that I wasn't going to do it again because I found myself very quickly on a kind of slippery slope. I was 4 years a professional, and then I stopped in 1989 and started work as a journalist, and decided that the first thing I should do before I began my career in journalism was to explain my years as a professional cyclist and the doping problem that for me represented a cancer at the heart of the sport.
That must have gone down like a lead balloon with some of your fellow pros.
Well, we liken it to the Omerta, the Mafia Omerta, that if you actually speak out against the problems in the sport, you'll be frowned upon. And when I wrote Rough Ride in 1990, I returned to the Tour the year after as a journalist. And one of my former teammates, who hadn't actually read my book because it wasn't published in French, but had heard all this stuff about me, inverted commas, spitting in the soup, caché dans la soupe was the term they used, and writing this book about the drug problem, and he actually literally came over and abused me without ever having read what I wrote, and that was quite hurtful.
Well, I think the shocking thing even now is that your first brush with drugs was, as you say, in a room with all your teammates, and they were all taking them without questioning it. Where did it all begin, though? There must have been a time, mustn't there, when cycling was drugs-free?
One of the reasons that it is, it does have such a doping problem, it is such a difficult, difficult sport. So this would have started initially with, I suppose, you know, pain relievers, mm-hmm. anything to relieve pain. And that leads to something else, and that leads to something else. So that temptation to relieve some of that pain and to get yourself an edge or give yourself the same edge as you feel your competitors are using is it's what's led to a lot of the problems we have now.
So drugs are there really to get you through the pain barrier, but how much of an edge do they give you? I mean, there are certain sports you can look at. You can look at cricket and golf and you think, well, if you were taking drugs, probably more fool you. I can't see what advantage you'd get from that. But how much of an edge do you get from taking drugs in cycling?
The difference between not doping and doping is absolutely astronomical, because it's not just the physical benefits that you get from these drugs. It's the psychological buzz that you get from knowing that you're actually competing on a more level playing field. in the last 20 years or more recently, it's changed now. I think the doping has become much more sophisticated.
So what has changed then? You talk about testing being much more sophisticated these days, but obviously every time the authorities, I suppose, ratchet up their efforts, then people get cuter, don't they, in dodging round the tests. What do you think of the tests for this year's Tour de France, for example?
In my time, we worked with, they were called soigneurs, these team helpers, who many were actually former racers, and they were kind of like witch doctors. They had these little potions and pills and stuff that they found had worked for them. But what has changed now is that, as I say, the level of doping became much more sophisticated. You had now sports scientists going in here, and they understood the doping products, they understood the controls, they understood the way around the controls, and now you had a race between their expertise in bringing this edge to the athletes they're working with for huge reward. I mean, these guys are getting paid huge money by their clients, by their cyclists, and a race between those guys and the testing people who are actually trying to, you know, police the sport and keep it clean.
The flip side of what you're saying is that what you encountered, really, it must be very, very depressing starting a cycling race, thinking that everybody else in the race is cheating.
It's absolutely crushing. It was a crushing realisation to have had this as your childhood dream and to arrive, you know, at the summit of that dream and to discover that at the heart of that dream was this ugly, dirty secret of drugs.
Former Tour de France cyclist Paul Kimmage. A group of scientists have identified genetic markers which could predict whether an individual is likely to live to an extremely old age. That's to around 100 years old. A study, just published in the online version of Science Journal, says the scientists found they could predict whether people would live to their late 90s or beyond with 77% accuracy. But the scientists are urging caution about how this will be used. Claire Balderson asked one of the researchers, Dr. Thomas Perls of Boston University's School of Medicine, about their findings.
Well, we've studied centenarians for quite some time and noted that exceptional longevity runs very strongly in families. And that prompted us to proceed with the study of trying to find genetic factors that played a role in this exceptional survival that also entails really healthy aging, markedly delaying one's disability well into their 90s for over 90% of our sample.
Is it something in their DNA, something specific that stands out?
Yeah, so we found these 150 genetic markers that if you have certain variations of these markers, it can be highly predictive of one getting to extreme old age. If you have certain other variations, it's highly, you know, it can show that you're not going to get to such an age based just upon those genetics. Another 23% of our centenarian sample had no signatures that were predictive of getting to these very old ages, and they were getting to those ages. So it speaks to the fact that there's still quite a bit of variability in terms of how one gets there.
But does it suggest to you that you could, in theory, be able to test the child at birth and work out whether there'll be someone who lives beyond 99?
Yes, it does.
And what are the implications of that?
Well, certainly I'm not sure anybody would want to make any decisions based upon that. And I think certainly in terms of social entitlements and things like that, that it should absolutely not be the case. It may be down the road that having information about whether or not one is at increased chance of delaying something like Alzheimer's disease may be of utility in terms of screening and prevention. Also, the genetic factors that we're looking at, these longevity-associated factors, could down the road lead to finding medications that would help us decrease risk for certain age-related diseases, but certainly not to get a lot of people to 100.
And you have expressed, as I said, there have been some sort of worries about people using this, people rushing into testing. That is something you're concerned about.
Yes, I think there's still a great deal we need to learn in other populations, what their signatures are, the differences between these populations. We'll learn a lot more about how and why people age differently. There's no way this is ready for prime time. I'm quite worried about hucksters and scammers saying that they can do certain things with this test.
Dr. Thomas Perls of Boston University's School of Medicine. And that's all from us for now, but an updated version of the Global News podcast will be available for you to download in 12 hours. I'm Komla Dumo. Until next time, goodbye.